Hello, this is Yarrow, and welcome to Vested Capital episode number 27, featuring my guest, Teddy Kires, the founder of the Group Orbis Mortgage Brokerage. Vested Capital is a podcast about how people make money and put their capital to work. I interview startup founders, angel investors, venture capitalists, crypto and stock traders, real estate investors, and leaders in technology. Today, I had the pleasure of hosting my friend Teddy, who is actually my mortgage broker here in Montreal, Canada. Over the last 3-4 years, I've been purchasing a few properties, a triplex, a condo, and the bottom of a duplex that I currently live in. And Teddy was my financier, my mortgage broker. He helped me get the finance for all three properties. And that was a little bit difficult because I came to Canada from Australia. I have a passport for both countries, but I have no tax record here in Canada. And I certainly didn't have what the traditional banks would need in order to qualify me for a standard mortgage. So when I started investing here, I needed to find alternative forms of financing through what you would call a B lender. These are different, not A-level banks, but they're still financial institutions that provide home loans. And provided I would have like 20% down for my initial payment on the property, I could get loans. Unfortunately, the loans often had a higher interest rate. That's just part of the process of going through a B lender. But the idea is you're only with them for 1 or 2 years while you get the necessary criteria in place to then switch over and refinance at a better interest rate with one of the A lenders. At least that's what I've been doing over the last 3-4 years now that I have a tax history here in Canada. So I invited Teddy because he's got a bit of a reputation here in Montreal as just being a total legend in the financing mortgage broker space. He worked for 10 years at the Bank of Montreal as a peak performer. He was really doing far above the average as a mortgage broker representing Bank of Montreal, at one point doing as much as 800 clients a year and about 500 deals. So that's far and above the typical average for a mortgage broker. So I wanted to hear how he was able to, you know, first of all, become an amazing mortgage broker. What does it take to succeed in that kind of career in financing people's homes? But then also how he started his own brokerage. So 4 years ago in 2018, or a little bit less than 4 years, he broke away and started his own mortgage broker so he could hire brokers to work under his own brand, teach them, train them on his systems and his process. And today he's got a team of 60 and is one of the most high profile mortgage brokerage firms in Montreal. So we talked about that, how to switch to his own company, how he grew it, what it looks like to run a mortgage brokerage. But also I asked Teddy throughout this interview about property investing and financing. He has himself been a property investor throughout his entire career. So we talked a little bit about what his strategy is in terms of what types of properties he's bought. Is he a buy and hold? Is he a buy and renovate and flip? What is his strategy? How does he manage the properties that he owns? And I also asked him some questions regarding the future of lending and finance. I've been interested in DeFi recently. So I asked him a question about DeFi, basically decentralized finance, and how that might impact the home loan lending space. And also just what he recommends today if you are interested in getting into property, you know, some basic questions around financing and how best to finance your first purchase and then ongoing purchases if you can, you know, continue to develop a portfolio of property investments. So we're definitely talking property investment and financing. That is the topic of this podcast. You know, this may not be your preferred method of investing. I'll be honest, it's not my main one, but I do like it because I've always been exposed to it growing up. It's the only asset class I feel comfortable presently anyway using leverage, which means financing, lending, borrowing money from banks in this case, which means obviously that I'm buying a property that's much higher than my own capital input into the value of the property. So potential gains are significant. Plus, of course, you've got this, the standard formula of your tenants paying back the mortgage over a long period of time. But it is just one finance tool, one investment method I use in the overall different buckets I have of investing. And obviously, Teddy's been a big part of it with me here in Canada. Prior to Canada, I did have properties in Australia, and I actually owned a condo in Ukraine as well for when I was living there. It's currently an Airbnb. So I have a little bit of property experience. I definitely do not call myself an expert, nor is it my main focus, but I do feel comfortable knowing that I've got these three properties here in Montreal. And just because of Canada being what it is, there's been some capital appreciation over the last couple of years, but there's also been a lot of hassles. I would say it's not been a smooth sailing process investing in property either. So, you know, a bit of a roller coaster ride, highs and lows, that's for sure. But if you're interested in property, and I don't think you need to be Canadian, certainly if you're Canadian, specifically in Montreal, you'll definitely find this episode interesting. But Teddy gave an overall view of what it's like to, you know, work as a mortgage broker, get financing for home loans, and as a property investor, what strategies he recommends and he uses. Okay, the other thing I want to mention to you is, of course, our sponsor for today's episode, which is InboxDone.com. I'm actually secretly trying to get Teddy to become a client of InboxDone. We had a little chat after I finished recording this interview because he has this large team of peak performing mortgage brokers working under him, and they deal with a lot of email. And one of the main concerns for a mortgage broker is you might miss a lead that pops into your inbox because you're so busy just servicing your current clients, just doing a great job, but you're getting all these new emails coming in every day. And there might be some leads sitting in there and you're just not getting back to them fast enough. So you might miss out on customers. That's a huge concern for mortgage brokers. It's a huge concern for a lot of industries. You could be a real estate agent. You might be missing out on potential buyers or sellers, you know, if those leads come through email. And if you're not fast enough and don't get back to them, another real estate agent could jump on that. Same with really any opportunity. It doesn't matter what kind of business. You might be doing big property deals. You might be buying and selling businesses. Whatever it is, if there's these opportunities flowing into a very crowded inbox, getting yourself an executive assistant to jump in there and process those emails, find those hidden deals that might be sitting in that, could be in the spam folder, could be in your main inbox, just in and amongst the other thousands of emails you have sitting in there. So they can basically look after all that, make sure you don't miss out on any deals, don't miss out on opportunities, reply to emails too. So they can even begin the process of actually nurturing those opportunities. So not only are you made aware that they exist, this person is actually beginning the process of converting that opportunity into a customer, a client, or whatever it is, a deal for you and your business. Not to mention just the mental relief, the clarity, the sense of more relaxed lifestyle you can have when you know it's someone else's responsibility to go into that inbox and reply to your messages, deal with all the everyday information that you don't need to deal with, you should not be dealing with, and then highlighting the small percentage of very important things you need to know about that come into your inbox. And that's exactly what InboxDone does. We're already working with real estate agents, property investors, doctors, dentists, lawyers, online coaches, venture capitalists, some car sales. The industries are all over the place, and we love helping any person who's dealing with too much email. Typically, we focus on helping the founder or the executive, the manager, the leaders in a company who are dealing with too much email in their personal and business inboxes. We can do customer service as well, although we tend to focus more on the leaders and the day-to-day work they do. They're not usually customer-facing, but for some of our clients, when they're doing both, they're doing all that leadership decision-making, but they're also dealing with maybe just questions about products and services. We deal with that, not to mention social media inboxes, replying to messages there, scheduling your calendar, collecting information to make sure your calendar is up to date with everything you need to know about the people you're going to be speaking to, data entry. So for example, with a mortgage broker, if you get a person signing up for a mortgage, you probably have to collect a lot of information from them and input that into certain software platforms. So your assistants can do the data entry for you as well. Pretty much anything an executive can do, an executive virtual assistant can do, we do that for you. But we specialize in managing email, where you do need a specialized skill set. And that's what we train and hire for. If you do become a client, you will get two executive virtual assistants assigned to you, and they can jump in and start clearing that email straight away for you and building a real system to manage your inbox. And then you can delegate more to them over time as well. If that is something you're interested in, you want to become a client, head to InboxDone.com. We'd love to have you as a client. Just book a discovery call. We'll learn more about your needs and we can decide the best fit, whether we will, you know, help you solve all these problems in your business and in your life. That's InboxDone.com. All right, now let's hear from Teddy, the founder of Group Orbis Mortgage Broker. All right, here we are with Teddy. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Yara. Very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, this is a little bit different of an interview because you and I have worked together. For those who don't know, Teddy is actually the mortgage broker who helped me acquire finance for some properties I purchased here in Montreal. And Teddy has a bit of a reputation here in this town for, well, being very good at what you do, being able to secure finance in situations that borrowers might not otherwise be able to. In fact, that's one of the reasons I came to you. As a small business owner, I didn't really have the history and, you know, especially as a Canadian, I'd only been here for a couple of years, not a lot of tax history. So I want to talk to you a little bit about financing a property, but also just, you know, your life as a mortgage broker and how you got so good at what you do And since the topic of vested capital is all aspects of growing capital and cash flow, I'd love to even know not just what you do as a mortgage broker, but what you do personally, Teddy, in terms of your own investments and so on. But let's start with your claim to fame, as we were joking about it before we hit record. Like, what's the big number or the claim to fame we can share about what you do and what you've done?
Yeah, so I've been in the business for about close to almost 15 years now. And originally, claim to fame was really if you would hit 100 million of volume in a single year, you've made it and you're doing very, very well. It was unachievable back then. And after, I think, my third year, I had done that. So, and now, as we had discussed, I own a mortgage brokerage that we have 60 or so brokers and internal staff. So we do a lot more than 100 million these days, but the original claim to fame was the first level of 100 million individually there.
When you say that, you mean 100 million in loans to your clients, is that?
Residential funded volume to our clients over a 12-month period. Right now, there's many people that can do over that, but back in late 2000s, it was different, right? The ticket sizes were less, and it wasn't as it is currently right now. Less people would use broker services and more or broker or mortgage professional services, and more would actually just walk into a branch and do their deal. It's really changed the outlook of the industry in the past few years there.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. I guess maybe as we go back in time and look at your history, the whole idea of going to a mortgage broker might not have been common. So it'd be kind of interesting to see when that pops up. And obviously today as we talk, it's very normal, but it wasn't always, right? You used to walk into your bank and just ask for a loan, right?
Yeah. So when I started, I graduated from McGill University. I started working at the Bank of Montreal, BMO, back in the day. And, you know, you did your jobs, your standard opening bank accounts and standard job at the bank.
Is that what
there.
You did? And you were a teller to begin
with?
That
was, I started from there. Yeah, I was, a teller at the beginning. So throughout those years, mortgage brokering, it was called mortgage specialist and loan officer in the bank. And so I transitioned from a pure branch role to like a loan officer role. And that was really when the transition in the late 2000s was becoming where mortgage professionals had like a specific designation and you had specialists to specialize in that type of financing. Because previously you wanted a mortgage, you went to the bank, the rate was all the same for everybody. And you know, what percentage of financing you'd get. As it progressed, really, there was a lot of different types of scenarios. As you said, self-employed, Beacon scores, FICO scores, depends on non-residents, new immigrants, a lot of different types of situations where you would need more products and more specialty to deal with them. And then it was in 2018, actually, I opened my own brokerage. And so I worked in financial institutions up until 2018. And 2018, I went independent as a mortgage brokerage, a broker and a brokerage to have access to essentially all the financial institutions in the country. And it really gives our clients more options and a lot more chance of having the best product for their needs there.
Can we go back all the way even before you were in university when you're born and raised? Were you actually a local Montreal?
Yeah, I was born in Montreal, raised in Montreal. I played hockey before. That was my previous whole career was completely focused on hockey. So I did move away for a little bit.
How was the hockey career?
It lasted a couple of years, but that was it. And then once I realized I was not making the NHL, that I did a 360, said I better go back to school so I can make some money in life here. So that's what I did.
I was going to ask actually, what were your money role models growing up? Like, I guess the answer now clearly hockey was plan A. In terms of other members of your family or people you knew at the time, were you looking at how they were creating wealth and going, I see property as an option, or I see business as an option, or trading stocks or whatever. Was that in your life at that early stage?
Yeah, for sure. So I come from a family of entrepreneurs, from my grandfather who immigrated here from Greece. So we're Greek origin, but my father was born in Canada, in Montreal, and I was born in Montreal. But and he was an entrepreneur. My father was an entrepreneur. They had some real estate and and basically I've started when I was really young, just understanding the business, understanding You know, it was different. Again, the leverage is much more important now than it was back then. And listen, I think it's taken a whole new, you know, aspect here. But, you know, so I, over the years, I did unsee that. I have learned that over the years. And really, that's part of probably the major reason why I did a 180 from being a more a hockey player and dedicating my whole life to that to, you know, okay, I have to go back to school. I want to get an education. I want to understand, you know, finance, economics, you know, and so, you know, and that's really what shifted me there.
Okay. So if your family was full of entrepreneurs, what type of businesses did they have? Is it all over the place?
Or? Yeah. So they had supermarkets. So my grandfather had started a supermarket chain here in Montreal. And then my father took it over and he sold probably 20 years ago or so, but they were always in the supermarket business. And then they had some real estate on the side, but their main focus was really the supermarkets. Back then there wasn't the big chains, and it was really the local supermarkets that were the big thing. And honestly, from a business perspective, I did see the transition in the supermarket business from, you know, the small mom and pop to the big chain, and how scale is important, and how, you know, the economies of scale and just really, you know, looking at things from a macro point of view versus a micro point of view is really important. And that changed the industry completely. And that's part of the reason why they had to sell, because they couldn't compete with the big stores anymore and the pricing that they had. Okay. There.
So you never had aspirations to get into the grocery chain business at all?
No, I didn't want to stay in the family business. And realistically, they had sold I would think it was a university that had sold the stores. And it was too complicated. Family business, sometimes you want to stay out of it. I went completely my own direction there. When I graduated, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I just started working at the bank, because that was what the thing, you know, it's a good job to work at the bank. And then you sort of learn from there.
Okay. So yeah, I can imagine you've seen a type of business, the grocery store business, which, let's be honest, is probably not, I don't know if there's any similarities between the mortgage finance world and grocery. Must be some overlap that I don't know about, but it seems quite different when I think of my understanding of those two companies. So you didn't really grow up thinking, okay, even if the family grocery business is closing, I do want to get into retail or something like that. You were like, nope, I'm studying finance, and then I'll see what happens, get a job at a bank. So when you're in, go ahead.
Yeah, it was more of the bank. I had no aspirations to even the business. And really, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated. And I just wanted to, do I go towards investment banking? Do I go towards and doing a CFA and going towards the finance aspect? And I just bought myself some time by getting a job at the bank. And really, that's where it opened a lot of opportunities for me really understanding the importance of financing and leverage in people's life. And that I loved it. I started enjoying it. And that's really what brought my career aspirations and how I could move forward there.
So explain then, when you're actually in the bank, you know, as an employee, obviously at the teller, you're just getting customer service experience, but eventually you get the chance to move inside and do other types of roles. What was it that appealed to you with financing in particular?
Well, it was pretty simple. So I was like a teller for a couple months, and then I became a generalist, right? So like the financial service manager, they call it at BMO. And so you do a little bit of everything. You do investing, you know, bank accounts, lending, basic lending. Why I liked the financing part of it is really because people needed you. You know, I said, investment, you know, you put, and I understand it's much more complex than that, but you put your money with a certain stock, you're relying on the stock, and, you know, it's, you're basically chasing people's money all the time and hoping that, you know, you can raise a certain amount of money for your portfolio and go like that. But on the financing end, if you were creative, if you did use your brain and understand the rules of the bank and understand to what level, because often when I was in the bank, I'm like, no, as per policy, you are allowed to approve this deal because of, you know, policy, you know, 12.2. And using that was just, I think, an advantage to me. So, and then that's really what sprung forward. I'm like, do I go towards the investing or the financing side? And I'm like, well, if people need me, they're going to request my services much more. I won't be constantly chasing money. I'll be trying to get clients, but it sort of snowballs after that, after you do a good job with one person there.
Interesting. Okay. So take us forward within the banking system. So you start getting into financing. What do you learn in financing? Is it just bigger deals as you get more trust built up? Like how do you accelerate in that type of career?
Well, it's really doing more deals, obviously doing the amount of deals, but it's all the complexity, right? So I guess in the bank, you know, as you have more experience, you do more and more deals. But I did financing from commercial. We did some commercial financing when I was before mortgage specialist. I did some at BMO, but also, you know, big financing of you know, the large towers, the 500 units. And so as you go, you see the different situations of different people. And as you specialize in it, essentially everybody wants to buy, like when you have a condo building, like I would do those big condo buildings in Montreal where you'd finance essentially everybody in the building. Well, there's everybody has different situations, right? And you'd see, you'd have the non-residents, you'd go and put a certain amount of percentage down and buy it. You'd have the difficult file. So you have a good global view of everything. And at the same time, you know, I had a whole team and, you know, and so you're able to do a lot of deals and touch a lot of different situations there.
I'm curious too, as you advance then, before you have your own mortgage brokerage, you're still in the banking system. How are you rewarded? Do you just get an increase in salary? Because there's no commissions, are there, for bank staff?
No, it is commission. So after I think 24 months when I was in the branch, I said, that's it. I want to make some money. And it's a pure commission job when you work as a mortgage specialist / loan officer in a bank. And that's where I just took off, right? My salary went from, you know, 10 times in 1 year. And just, you know, that's, and then I'm like, okay, now let me try to scale this. And I believe from what the infrastructure that the institution had, which was BMO, and I love BMO, great bank. And it just, I think I scaled it to the max that I could at the time. And really I wanted to scale this much further. And you know, banks are made a certain way. They have a certain limitation of things that you can do and how you can do things. And that's, I understand fully why they would do that. And so, it's, you know, essentially it was like a normal transition to owning a brokerage after, where you have, you know, 60 mortgage professionals that you're teaching them each, you know, each one of them want to do $50 to $100 million of volume. And you're teaching them each how the different tactics and how to scale their own personal business there.
Okay. So before we do switch to Group Orbis, your mortgage broker part of the story, though, if you went from whatever it was to 10 times that amount, thanks to commissions, two questions. How did you do that? Like, do you just get out there and like network like crazy, and or does word of mouth drive all these new people coming and asking for Teddy at your branch? And then second question, maybe you can answer it afterwards. I'm assuming your own net worth was increasing. At some point, you must be thinking, well, I'm also going to get into property, since that would be the logical thing to do with your own money as well.
Yeah. So yes and yes for both of them. But on the first question, how I actually did it, when I was given an area. So in Montreal, I was given the La Salverdon area. That was the original area, which you would know.
Yeah, that's where I am.
Exactly. And I had no idea about the area. I'd visited there a few times, maybe a couple of arenas. But I went for a drive and I really strategized. Really, you're given a computer and you're saying, go get business. And there's actually not supposed to get any walk-ins from the bank. So you're essentially just going out and getting business externally. And I'm like, okay, where do deals come from? I'm like, okay, well, realtors touch the deal at first. Okay, so let me call the realtor offices here in LaSalle. And so I did call. I called every real estate office and owners at the time. And I struck a couple deals with the different offices to actually have my own personal office in their office. And I said, okay, well, there's 150 realtors here. If I rent an office here, then I'm going to meet them. I'm going to meet everybody. And then my chance of getting a deal is much higher. And so the first, you know, at first.
Does that mean you have to go from office to office throughout the day? Like, if that's a lot of offices.
I rented one big one at one big office and then at smaller ones everywhere else. But I would try to manage my day accordingly, where I'd go like one day here, the next day, the other one. And I would just sit there and I just talk to people, and it just snowball from that, because you would talk to somebody, a couple times, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. Eventually, a deal comes. Eventually, somebody makes a mistake in the market. There's one, he goes to his own bank, or his client goes to his own bank, and they're not able to finance, or the person doesn't call back, or the person's on vacation. Okay, it could be a chance. And then that's when you get that chance, you can grow it. And you do a good job, and then you can, you know, create those relationships long term. And so I just it's a numbers game, right? I'm like, okay, if I want to do, because at first it was like 50 million was like, you know, 50 million was a top producer at BMO at the time. Oh, if I can do, I don't know, if I can do 2 deals a week, which is a 100 deals a year at $350,000 a deal, I'm doing 35 million. Okay, great. So let's concentrate on getting a certain, you know, 2-3 leads a week. To fund that. And then quickly it grew much faster than that. And that's, you know, that's where it's really did change my life, because A, you're making a lot more money just to survive, right? And I was a young guy, so all the money I was making, it was really, you know, I was investing it all. And that's essentially when I started just buying different properties, because, you know, for me, it was just the, instead of keeping a bank account or instead of putting them in the stock market, I really wanted to invest into properties. Sort of like you, Yarrow, where, you know, I like them. It's interesting. And you learn over the years, you know, what works, what doesn't work. I've made some mistakes. I've made some great buys. And especially this is a great time to own real estate with the market rate, markets going much higher than it was even 12 months ago. And so, and I've used that, and I've learned a lot of what I learned is also from my own personal properties that I've owned there.
Okay. Can we go back to your first property? Do you remember which one it was?
Yes. It was a triplex in the Outremont area of Montreal.
Oh, nice. Okay. And do you remember the details of the deal and like what year that was?
That was 2008, maybe 2007, 2008, around there. And I just, you know, I bought it with my father, actually, 50-50, and we put half the money each, and we gutted it and renovated it, and we sold it. We made a little bit of money, but it was just okay. I'm like, okay, we spent the thing a little bit too much money on the renovations, I refinanced it. I kept it, and I learned about penalties, because I actually refinanced it, and then, you know, had a 5-year fixed mortgage rate, and I wanted to sell it after a year or two, and the penalty was like 30 or 40 grand. I was like, oh, I'm not going to spend 40 grand to break this mortgage here. And then I realized, okay, maybe after taking consideration penalties when I'm taking financing and learning it. But it was my first one was an okay. I didn't lose money. Didn't make that much money. It was good to learn from it. But then I learned a few different aspects after that.
That sounds like a flip rather than, you know, buy a burr, as is
called. Well, it was to keep. Originally, it was to keep. And then I didn't want partners after that. So I just, but my dad, let's just sell it and we'll go on from there, basically.
Yeah, so. Fair enough. No, it makes sense. I think my first property I bought with my mom too, and then I bought her out because it just gets too confusing.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. Confusing is a nice way to put it. Yeah. So, okay. Interesting. Just to circle back though to the networking and getting an office and all these real estate agencies as a way to get clients. Correct me if I'm wrong, but 10xing your sales at the age you were at would not have been common, right? Probably still not even common today. So what makes Teddy, even that Teddy, not today, but going back, that younger Teddy when he was still working at the bank, what made him different?
Well, what I did is when I first became a mortgage specialist, that's the title. I looked at the top 2-3 people around me in a BMO, and I went and took them out for lunch. And I wanted to understand what makes them the best, right? One person is a networking, the other person is it, you know, the deal knowledge. Another person is it, how do you market to your realtors and so forth. So, you know, I did a lot of, I analyzed a lot of people. I read every book there was on mortgages, and, you know, don't ask me the names, in 2007, but I Googled, I guess Amazon, I put in Amazon all the different books out there, and I actually read them. I didn't just buy books to buy books. And so I really created something that I wanted. I created a business plan. And I think what made me different than others is really sticking to it. And not giving up. There's some days that are tough, But if you actually have a business plan, and your business plan is going to switch after, you know, 30 days, I have to remove some things and added some things. But essentially, I was there from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. every day working in the office. And I was consistent about that. And you just, you have to, if you're consistent and you use the, doing the right methods, and you're actually constantly analyzing your business and making little tweaks to it, you're able to do that. And that, with the market, was good at the time. I think that there was not many people were soliciting people like the way I was, not just like a used car salesman type of thing, but it was more, you know, I was creating relationships and just constantly doing the same thing, doing the right things, always being present. For me, it made a big difference. And then it just snowballs after that, because then it just, once you created a base, then those people tell about others, and, you know, and it just, you know, we doubled the year after that, and it just continued going from that part of that point of view here. So, and understanding how to use a team, because back then nobody had assistants. Maybe some people had one assistant, but after a couple of years, I actually had like had six assistants. I just hired, and I just created a whole team of people that were helping me and analyze my business, saying, okay, I make money if I speak to somebody. I don't make money when I'm keying in the application, when I'm asking the client for a pay stub, where's my value when I'm giving advice, when I'm talking to realtors. And that's essentially how I, on my end, it, you know, it's the best way of operating.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't realize a mortgage broker within a big bank is almost like their own business owner. Like, if it's all is commission based, you're growing your own team, which work for you. I assume you employed them, the bank didn't employ them, right? So, yeah. Okay. Interesting. Switching back
again. Well, the bank employed them, but I paid for them.
Okay. So, it's almost like a franchise in some ways, right? Like, you get to use the bank.
I did think of it as a franchise, essentially. I did have, you know, predictions at the beginning of the year, revenues, my expenses. You know, you have an employee, you have employees, you have six employees, you have offices, you have expenses, right? And then, so I knew what my numbers were, what my average commission is going to be, and how much I predicted the following year, right? And I did that every year, and it just really helped me focus and understand where I want to go, and give myself goals. And you know, and again, when you make a big check, you know, let's say you make a $10,000 check, you don't just give up. Now, a lot of people just make 10, 20, 30 grand, say, oh, you know, let me take a month off here. so that's not what I, you know, what was happening there. You know?
It's quite a parallel to real estate agents as well. I'm thinking of Anna, who's my agent, who introduced me to you. She tells me similar stories. You know, it's like, how hard does she work? She hires assistants, and yeah, very similar business model. But I'd like to go back to your own investing side of this, because, all right, you did the first deal with your dad, then you sold it, then you learned from that, okay, I'm going to go solo. How did you continue to invest? Was it still plexes? Like, was there a reason why you were choosing those kind of properties?
Yeah. So in Montreal, there, you know, as you know, plexes are a big thing, where you have, you know, three, four tenants or apartments in one building, and you buy the building. I like that strategy. What I had, you know, I had a little bit of vacancy problem in Outremont at the time. And I said, okay, I'm not going to buy properties where I'm going to worry about getting a tenant in there. I'm going to buy properties where I'm comfortable, I understand it. And I basically went to the McGill, around McGill. And I bought a lot of the student housing buildings around there, because A, I don't want to worry about vacancy, and B, I think that they're undervalued, some of them, where you can, the students will pay a lot of money because you're right next to the school. Doesn't matter what happens. And, you know, COVID's actually a good example. People still want to go to school. People still want to live there. You know, it's almost like, even during COVID, I don't think we had any one or two vacancies, but minimal. Like, it was very, very minimal versus some of the other buildings out there. So I had a strategy of what I wanted, and whatever came on the market, I went about. And, you know, then you create a team, because I'm not going to start managing and the properties and going to pick up rents and, you know, if a heater's broken, to go fix it up. So you create an infrastructure of a team and everything. So I had a team in mortgages, I had a team in my property management. And that's how you can scale both of them, right? And that's essentially, I think that's how any business is, right? You can't do everything yourself. You have to basically trust people and let them leverage your time like that.
Okay, so your strategy going back then with the property was really student housing, multi-unit buildings, buy and hold. You weren't planning on flipping or anything at then.
Buy and hold, refinance after 3-4 years, and buy another one, and then keep on scaling.
Okay,
like that.
Great. So one of my main complaints as a new person to Montreal, having come from Australia, I think you've heard me say this, is management of rental properties, where in Australia, every real estate agent has a rental management unit, and you just choose which real estate agent you want to go to, and you literally just hand your properties over to them, and they will collect the rent, do the inspections, you know, hire any contractors. Everything is completely hands-off. They just deposit the rent minus expenses. I come to Montreal, not as common to find that kind of service. They do exist, but few and far between. And it seems like not the most thriving industry, let's put it that way. Back when you started, did you have to basically build and train a team of just people you hired, or were, did you hire an agency back then? Like, what did it look like for management?
The first few, like, I was doing it. And then as I grew, I did get, I don't want partners, but I did get a few people in that were owning it with me that would manage it. Okay. So it's like you have a small, like they put some money in, but you'd have a small piece, but you'd also manage the building. I give you a certain amount of money to manage the building. And so every building had a couple partners there for that who would manage it. And then today we have a team, right? We have like, we don't have that many units, but we have, you know, a team of 3 or 4. I have a partner that I do buy my properties with. That is essentially an entrepreneur as well in a different domain. But and then so we have our infrastructure, but it does take a little bit of time to doing that. And that's really like, again, you know, you almost need to buy to get to a level where you can have a full-time employee to manage the properties. You're right that there are a few rental companies here, like rental property management companies, but it's you know, it's a little costly and it's not as user friendly. It's not as popular as it is. A lot of people do themselves here, and that's what it is. Some realtors do it, but it's, you know, it's not as it's not like that much of a business. But I think that, you know, having your own employees is much easier to control them and to
Which point, like, did you feel you were comfortable to hire a person as an employee for your, like, did you feel like I have to have 10 doors or 20 doors or X number of cash flow when I can do that?
It's almost like revenue, right? Okay. Like if you're, you know, if you have, I don't know, $500,000 of gross revenue, and 5% is like what, 25 grand or so. So like, okay, I can have somebody maybe part-time or like half their time is there, and then half the time they're doing something, and then sort of grow from there, right? Because, you know, that's why I bought the Ghetto, because the McGill Ghetto, that's the location, because I would buy a building, the rents would be, you know, $3,000 a unit. So $3,000, I'd buy 4 units, it'd be, what is it, $12,000, $144,000 a year of gross revenue, where it's like, okay, you know what, like, okay, I need a couple of these and I'll be okay, right? And I didn't want to manage the units that were like $600 a month or $700 a month that were just low value for me. I wanted to manage the high value, the high ticket sizes. And from a, you know, again, parallel to mortgage brokering, obviously you want to have the bigger mortgages, right? Because you make more money and the same amount of effort, the same mentality from investing, where I'm like, okay, you know what? If I have a building that I have a certain amount of revenue versus buying one little condo where I can, it's only like $600 a month, it's a lot, the same amount of management, same amount of time, but, you know, I can afford somebody when I have large revenues versus smaller revenues. Mm-hmm.
Then. Okay. Yeah, makes sense. In terms of like your long-term strategy with property and maybe even today and this, the whole progression, have you always had this kind of, I'm going to buy one new something a year, or is it when a deal comes to you, or are you actually looking every day? Because obviously you run a mortgage brokerage. Even before that, you were running essentially a mortgage brokerage just under BMO. That was your day job. So you can't be sitting there searching Centris, which is our version of, you know, Zillow or whatever you want to call it, in for searching properties, or you had access to the MLS, right? Is that what it's called in Canada too? I think. Yep. So, you know, you can find properties, but that's not your job, so to speak. So how did you treat that? As is it a side hustle for you? What was the focus?
As you create relationships, the opportunities come by you, right? And yes, I do. And my job is not just mortgage broking. Yeah, I own a mortgage brokerage, but I don't dedicate 100% of my time towards that. And I don't want to, because I want to grow. I dedicate, let's say, 80%, 85% of my time. I would still dedicate 15, 20% of my time to real estate. And I sort of split my day up like that. And I do want to, you know, maybe the 90-10 type of thing. I do want to have a certain amount of my time, because if I'm not looking, if you're not searching for it, it's not going to happen. And I do look at Centris often, or Matrix. I do get the emails from, you know, the realtors who say, oh, I have a new listing on. And I'm fully aware, although maybe not 100% of my time is there, but I'm fully aware what's happened in the market. I enjoy it, you know. So I enjoy, you know, instead of watching a TV show or something, I'll you know, analyze a certain area, what's happened in the market here. Do I look at it every single minute of every day? No. But the good opportunities, they'll, you know, I'll get an email for it, and I'm always looking to, you know, find a way to maximize my cash position by refinancing, and, you know, and not over leveraging, but having some money available that if there is an opportunity, then I can jump on it there.
Speaking of refinancing, question I've always wanted to ask you, Teddy. So great chance I can do this. What do you see as the appropriate time frame for refinancing? Is it something you should constantly be doing, like once every year or two, or is it purely based on market conditions? You see a better interest rate, then you do it, or even just personal conditions. You have a property situation where you have to refinance, whatever, for renovations. Like, what's your strategy, or even advice to clients, I guess, nowadays?
So that's a good question. It really depends on the person and the risk tolerance. You know, I don't like refinancing to a point where the new mortgage payment is going to be more than the revenues you're bringing in. So there's a loss on the property. Try to, you know, manage that a little bit, and not, unless you have a really good investment somewhere else that's going to offset that. But, you know, you try not to do that, to over leverage yourself, because if there is a downturn in the market and you essentially are breaking even, then it's okay. You can hold it an extra year or two. It doesn't make a difference if the value goes down the next day or the next month. Really, you're going to hold it for the time necessary. As long as you can cover your rents, as long as your cash flow is okay, you'll be fine on that end. We have terms, as you know, in Canada. The States is very different, and I don't know all the other countries, but I know the U.S. is very different here. There's penalties are a big thing. You don't want to take something that's too long term, and you don't want to you want to hedge against rising interest rates. So you want something maybe not too short term. So you. That comes into play, right? I don't want to refinance a property and going to pay like a $50,000 penalty, and unless it's worth it for me based on the interest rate at the time. But I try to avoid, you know, wasting money like that. You know, you try to time it properly. From, you know, the rate is the rate, and you know rates change every day. But it's really, for me, it's the cash flow of the property that's important. And then if I can maximize it, and I'm not living off my property, so it's not like I need to have a certain revenue for my properties to sustain my lifestyle. My properties are for my, you know, long-term wealth, my everyday revenues from my business, my operating business. And so when I look at it like that, I'm able to take a little more risk on what I buy, where, you know what, maybe it's not cash flow positive right now, but if I improve this, that, then I'll make a lot more money in a year. So I'm able to take that sort of risk on that end versus having a return immediately on the property that I have to buy. And, you know, you can't, because if I buy a property that's undervalued right now that I think that the rents aren't there, and I fix it up in 18 months, 24 months, and I can refinance then, right? And then I can take the money back and invest it somewhere else. But if I buy a property that's maxed out, I can't refinance in 2 years. You know, it's, well, I'm going to get 10 grand, 20 grand out of it. It's not worth it. You know, you want to basically, depends on the property that you own. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a lot of finance questions, but I want to continue back in your story, and I'll save the finance ones for as we get past that. So you spent 10 years at BMO, and I think it was 3 years ago you decided to, I say branch out, but it's almost like you just no longer work with BMO. You start your own thing, and you can work with every bank. How does it work? How do you transition? Like, do you lose all the, because I know with mortgages, there's like the commissions are trailing. So it's like an ongoing thing, not always an upfront one-time thing. So if you switch over to start your own thing, really tell me, how did you make that decision to switch over when you're working for BMO?
Actually, commissions are upfront here in Canada. The majority, there's very minimal that they're trailing, but it's mostly upfront. You are building your revenue every year. in 2017, you know, I had my mortgage broker's license in Canada for like quite a while, in Montreal for quite a while, but I never activated it. And I was always looking for the right opportunity. And then in 2017, I had the fortunate opportunity of meeting a mentor of mine. His name is John Barges. And so John, he's the owner of CIMBIC, which is called the Coalition of Independent Mortgage Brokers Canada. And CEO is the legend here in Canada from the mortgage front. And, you know, we had a really good conversation, and really his vision and his long-term outlook are match what my vision was. And I did always want to do more. I felt for 2-3 years, I was sort of maxed out and really couldn't do much more volume than what I was doing. But with John's vision and his coaching.
Sorry to interrupt, Teddy. I'm just curious, why is it maxed out? Like, what is the thing that stops you when you're in a bank?
Because you have to talk to every client, and you only have a certain amount of hours in the day that you can do that. So if you're going to talk to, you know, I think I was doing about 800 clients a year or so at the end, where I was doing 800 applications, a certain percentage of it was funding. But, you know, you're speaking to 800 people, and that's applications. You have to speak to a lot more people to actually get it. Your time is limited.
And you can't hire brokers under you.
No, not the bank. As a broker, as a mortgage broker, you can. And that's where I'm like, okay, well, if I take this method that worked for me and I can coach the right people with the right mindset in the right infrastructure, and that was where John came in, where his brokerage out over in Ontario, Toronto, and the rest of Canada, really have, it's a really good infrastructure that he has. I use that infrastructure. I can coach the right people. We have the best of both worlds, and I can help them scale their business. And I'm essentially scaling my business at the same time through them. And really, that's how we can get it much bigger there.
Okay. So how does that's conceptually why you do it. In terms of practical, how do you do it?
Practical.
Yeah. You just go tell BMO I quit, and then you buy yourself.
Oh, well,
how does it work?
I had prepared it for it was about 6 months preparing it. You know, the branding, because it's all mine, right? Orbis is 100%, you know, mine, and I had to just create the brand, I had to create the everything. And I was sort of preparing myself over that amount of time. And then just one day I just went in and I'm like, okay, now's the next few weeks is the time. Because I actually gave birth, my wife gave birth to my daughter. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm taking 2 weeks off the bank. Just because I can think, I'm like, you know what? When I come back, I'm done. I'm gonna just make the transition. I called up John. I said, okay, I'm gonna join it in 2 weeks. And then I walked into the bank and I spoke to my boss at the time, who actually now works with me. She works as a manager in my team. But I spoke to Time and I said, listen, these are my plans. If you want, I will give you a 2 week notice, because I know that I had a lot of the builders in Montreal that I was managing and everything. I said, you know, I'm not competing against you. It's completely different. And I'm not going to another institution. I'm really starting my own thing. And they actually kept me on for 2 weeks to help them. Just, you know, usually they'll just fire somebody immediately or just tell you to go home. But I helped, you know, the transition to create, you know, I wanted to leave on good terms and be in the right, you know, mindset with them and everything. And so it did end very, very well. They knew that it was sort of, they essentially had a feeling that there was a time when I was going to leave them. And then I basically walked in that one day and I said, I'm gone. And, you know, then I had to start creating the relationships at the other banks, because I had relationships at BMO. I didn't have relationships at Scotiabank, at TD Bank, at, you know, Desjardins. You know, at all the different institutions here in Home Trust, Equitable, I had to rebuild those relationships. And, you know, I did it all pretty quickly, but it was all a very hectic time, but it was all worth it there.
Okay. Yeah, I can imagine the BMO wants to keep you on side too, because hopefully you're going to send them still some deals, even though you're no longer going to be 100% them.
Well, BMO is actually one of the banks that doesn't work with mortgage brokers directly, so it's not like they do fund some of the virtual lenders in the back end, but they don't work with mortgage brokers directly. There's a couple institutions that don't do that.
Right, so you are clean.
Well, we still have good relationships with them, you know, so we don't send the clients, but we still have good relationships. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So you go out on your own, you knock on a few doors with other banks and say, hey, I'm Teddy, I own Group Orbis, looking to create relationships for possibly sending clients to you for mortgages. I'd love to know at this point too, because this, correct me if I'm wrong, would be the time where you also could expand the scope of your clientele to potentially service people like me, where, because I wouldn't have not been able to go to BMO when I first looked for finance. I, as you taught me, there's this thing called A lenders and B lenders. A lenders being the main banks, B lenders being alternative finance sources, which I used for my first few loans. That must have been now available to you as well, which opens up new clientele. Is that kind of what you had to do then? Make a lot of relationships and then open up your marketing to new people?
So first of all, the from the lender relationships, I had the relationship with the John Barges and Simbic. So I was able to leverage their relationships across all of Canada to create the financial institutions and maintain those and just grow on it. So that was, I was okay on that end. It was, yeah, creating the network of new clients, where it was great because we still had the clients coming in. I still had a team, and I brought some people from the team over. I still had the clients coming in. But now we were able to open up to more different types of situations where you sort of rebuild your business. And really, for the first 6 to 12 months, I was actually doing mortgages, and I was growing it. And I've limited that a lot more now. Like, it's just very limited to who I actually – it's more I manage the firm now. But back then, it was – going out to realtors saying, if you use your person at XYZ bank and he gets refused, your client gets refused, send it to me, I'll find a solution. And I said, we essentially can approve anybody in Canada if they put 20% down. Now, the question is not if it's going to get approved. It's what is the rate, right? Is it at 1.5% or is that 15.5%? And so it's somewhere in between. So we do have the A banks, we have the alternative B banks, and we have the, you know, the private lenders, and they're institutions. There's like, it's not just somebody who's a private lender gonna, you know, wanna break your legs or anything. It's institutions that are specialized in this. Across the Canada is called a Mix, and here in Quebec it's really like, it's just companies here. But and so having the scope of products available was key for me, because then you will never lose a client. A, they're not going to get a better rate than what you're offering. And B, you're never going to lose a client from, you know, an approval perspective. Before, it was pushing BMO to approve the deal. Hopefully they approve the deal. Let's position it. Now it's what's your situation? Well, these 2-3 banks are the best for your situation, and here are the rates, right? And it's a different process, and I have to actually retrain myself how to sell, because it wasn't the same mindset as, oh, well, here's the rate, and push BMO to try to approve it, push them to try to get the best rate. No, it's like, no, I'm not going to push a bank. You give me your options, all the different institutions, and, you know, and reposition the client with the right institution based on their needs. So it's much more client friendly, where you're on the client side and not, you know, selling to a client. It's like the client comes here, it's like, we're together. This is the strategy. And like with you, for instance, this is the strategy, right? I think we had discussed that. This is a strategy going forward. I think we're going to do this. After some amount of time, it's going to go here, and it's going to go here. And I think it did work out. And that's that for me is, you know, situations like that where you have clients for life after is the key thing. And that's really how we've done that here.
Okay. So with Group Orbis, suddenly you're the man in charge now of your own brand, your own company. And like you said, one of the main goals was to train people. So you had a team of mortgage brokers. So no longer is Teddy doing 800 clients a year himself. It's maybe the entire firm is doing, I don't know, 5,000 clients a year, but we've got 5 mortgage brokers or 10 mortgage brokers, et cetera. Can you take me back to the first person you hired as a mortgage broker? And how did you imbue them with the Teddy methodology? Like, how did you pass on what you know?
It's a good question. So what I started in April 2018, and really I told myself for the first 12 months, I'm going to understand this business and learn it before getting people to join, because I want to actually give them value, not just sell to them. So I did have my team of assistants and whatever, but I think a month in, a friend of mine, I knew him, you know, personally, because I met a mortgage broker at another firm. I'd like to join you. I said, Brandon, I said, I can't right now. I don't even know what I'm doing right now. So give me a few months and I'll touch base with you and we'll go like that. So after about, you know, 2-3 months, I think he called me again and finally said, okay, now come on board. So for the first about 12 months, it was just people that I knew that were joining me. So it was actually easier because they were just sitting next to me. This is pre-COVID. So they're sitting next to me, you know, where I'm like client calls, I'm like, listen. And they would listen to the conversations, how I would talk to the client, how we'd position it. And it was really like hands-on learning. It wasn't, there's any specific method to it at the time. Now it's much more, you know, there's a whole process, but.
I don't know why, Tevye, I'm thinking Wolf of Wall Street with you sitting there listening to your protege and then yelling at him and all that sort of stuff.
No yelling. But yes, listen, I do try to create, the good thing about Wolf of Wall Street, it's like sort of the environment of people trying and working hard and everything. And so I did want to create a fun environment that people do work hard. And that's the, I do only hire people that want to achieve good volume. There's many different types of people. And I respect the people that say, you know what, I want to do this part-time, that's fine, but they don't fit my model and we don't hire them here. So we want people that are think similar to how we think here. And so then it was just, and then about 12 months after I started, I made a conscious effort of saying, you know what, I'm not going to do mortgages anymore. I'm going to perfect this type of thing. And I think that was a time, I think, when you came on or so, but so the people who I'd existed relationships with, I would maintain those relationships, but anybody new, I'd just give to my team. And that was really how we started to scale this, because then I created a training program for new brokers. Then I hired managers. Then I, you know, so you know, now we're 60, 70 people under Orbis, and we want to just double this in the next 12 months. And you know, but you need an infrastructure. You need knowledge. And then I think I acquired it over a certain amount of years, and then specialty when I was in the broker business for about 12 months. And then I'm like, okay, I have the knowledge. I have the relationships. My mortgage brokers are making the most money in the business. Let's scale this. And that's really how we, you know, how we did that and created, again, an infrastructure of people to, you know, when you onboard, what's the process? You know, when you want to, week one, what do you learn? Week three, what's the training like? And create like an environment for success to help them achieve their goals there.
It must be a very different role for you, because you were kind of like the front-facing mortgage broker guy, and now you're the CEO of a team of 60 plus. You spent a lot of your time hiring and training, and probably far less time talking to clients. Have you enjoyed being a CEO rather than a broker, I guess is the way to put it?
It's a completely different job. On my end, that's what I always wanted to do. I believe that's the only way I can grow properly. And speaking to clients is great. I actually like having success stories and hearing how I help people out, and it's great. Like it's, you know, it's limited in my time that I can actually do that, and that I won't get my ultimate goal, you know, to doing that long term. So, but I do love what I do, and I love seeing some of the brokers that come in, and you know, they're doing let's say 10 million of volume 1 year, and the next year they come in, they're doing 30 million of volume, and it just really, their life changed in the past 12 months, because financially they've, you know, tripled their revenue, and they're making a lot, and it's like, okay, having those successes are also great, right? And but you do deal with different challenges that, you know, you never dealt with as an employee, right? You deal with, you know, every day, you know, thinking about things that you never thought about when you're like, you know what, I have to think about that from an HR perspective, from a regulatory perspective, from everything, right? So there's a lot of different things that you are not responsible for.
As you know, maybe the listeners don't realize that, maybe they do, Canada, especially the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, has gone through an absolute boom in property prices and property volume trading. Obviously, that's been a boost to your company as well, with the number of mortgages constantly coming through you. I am curious, though, with Group Orbis now in particular, have you had to come up with a different or a more robust marketing side of your firm to bring in the clients? Because now you've got no longer just Teddy as an agent, you have, or a broker, you have whatever it is, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people all needing leads. That's a lot more lead flow. Maybe the answer is because the market was so booming, you had too many coming in. Or did you have to build a more substantial marketing angle? Or do they always go out there and work themselves? They're like little Teddies back in the day. They would do all the relationship building and bring in their own clients.
From a company perspective, I had to shift the marketing to a brand marketing, not just around myself. Like originally when I was, you know, BMO and this and that, it was about me, right? And so pictures of me and whatever. Then now it's consciously just a brand thing and creating that awareness. And it's nothing like, if you don't know, you wouldn't know that I own it, right? So it's not online, like under me. But from a how would I have to build from a marketing perspective? I do have good relationships with different realtors and office and owners over on the island and even provincially, where I did leverage those relationships, and I created corporate relationships for all my mortgage brokers, where you know, they'll go into an office of, you know, a Via Capital, for instance, and which is an agency down here. And so we've made, you know, so my realtors have access to that office, right? And they, you know, there's a certain commission split based on that. And so I've opened a lot of doors for the realtors, for the mortgage brokers with realtors. And I have coach them to go out and get their own business as well, where they need to have a mix of their business, where they get leads from us, they get the referral sources from us, but also they get their own referral sources, because you know, you never know which one's going to dry up one day. Okay. And just having to diversify where all your volume comes from is very important.
Does that include like social media, pay-per-click advertising, search engine optimization, going on podcasts to talk about things? Is that sort of in the marketing mix as well?
A little bit. We do have like a team, a company that manages our social media account that helps us, you know, with the ads, with stuff like that. And we are doing that a little bit. We, especially in this business here in Canada, it's very expensive because the banks are spending all this money on Google ads, and, you know, so it's like, I'm not going to compete against BMO, and they're spent online there. So it's almost, you know, how do you position yourself? You're not going to position yourself as a rate game, because there's, you know, corporate entities that have a lot more funds than I do in that space. So I position myself with the realtors, and that's where I think there is a lot of value with the referral, not just realtors, but referral sources as a whole. And yes, we do the branding online. We do some Facebook ads. We do some of that stuff. But the relationships with the owners of the different offices and the firms is how we can create those, create a more long lasting. Because we're not constantly spending money to position ourselves on, you know, ranking first or whatever it is there, you know. Sort of balance that out.
Okay.
You know?
So it's almost back to Teddy day one when you first started as a broker within BMO. You were, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I do want to switch to a few financing questions, but I do have one question about your brokerage and just the whole mortgage industry too in the future. And this is primarily because I've been maybe a little too deep in the future of like blockchain and AI and so on, in particular with DeFi. So, you know, decentralized finance. And I think about a business like yours, Teddy. So, you know, I don't know the numbers, but you're taking commissions. Your agents are taking commissions. The banks are taking commissions. It's like this pie that's getting sliced up along the way. And who knows, the bank might be going behind to another, you know, lending source, whatever the case may be. With DeFi, we remove all these middle people, and I'm foreseeing potentially a future. I don't know if you think about this or not. You might not have any answer for this, but a potential future one day as a client, I go to a decentralized financial source. There's only one source. It's like a group of token providers, cryptocurrency. I just borrow from that. I don't borrow from a bank. I don't borrow from individuals. I just borrow from this decentralized organization, as do other people, and it kind of runs itself. Theoretically, that is where we're heading with DeFi. Do you keep on top of any of that? Are you interested in any of it? Do you see yourself adapting some technologies in the future, even within your brokerage?
I think yes. Listen, I think that in the past 10 years, it's completely changed. The funding sources have changed here in Canada. And I think that in Canada, it's a little bit different because it's so protected. There's not that many institutions. And really there's one way to securitize it. It's a little convoluted. So I think it's a huge opportunity in the future. And that's why being a broker for myself is very important, because we give advice. We're not reliant on one certain source of financing. And I do think that there is a ton of opportunity out there for different sources of funding, whether it's through DeFi or through other lenders coming to Canada, or through different ways to make it more efficient. Because yes, there is a lot of waste of money through efficiencies here. And there's many different reasons why it's like that, from a regulatory perspective, where it's very tight-knit, it's controlled. That might be one of the the hurdles for DeFi is that the regulatory environment here, especially in Quebec, is tough, right? And they want to make sure, and Canada as a whole, you know, they want to protect the system and protect institutions there. And it really depends on what the cost of funds is from the DeFi perspective. And that's also important because, you know, the banks have ways to actually have very cheap cost of funds out there, especially in this environment. And it's very hard to compete with that and with the amount of money that they currently have. And they will protect themselves, I'm sure, you know, to make sure they protect their market share at all costs, everything. And it's almost like a, you know, they could borrow very cheaply from the Bank of Canada, and it's hard to compete against that. And that's the biggest hurdle. However, we talked about the alternative space. We talk about the private space. These are spaces that I think there's not that many funding sources, and there could be a huge opportunity, especially with, you know, with different sources, especially like DeFi. Or there's a whole market out there.
Yeah. That's possible. And of course, if inflation kicks in, suddenly that lending source isn't so cheap for the banks and so forth as well. So, you know, exactly. You can go both ways.
You never know what's going to happen. But I do think that just the way they underwrite deals has changed tremendously in the past 15 years. And I think that the next 10, 15 years, it's going to be huge. And I believe we're well positioned as mortgage brokers because we don't care. Whatever's best for the client, whether it's BMO, Desjardins, Scotia, or whether it's XYZ, you know, DeFi company, whatever it is, that's better for you. Yarrow, okay, we're going to go here. And that's your best bet here, you know? So I on our end, that's why I actually saw, like, not from the DeFi, but I saw that there was a huge change in the environment of financing. And that's really why I was looking for a change from BMO, because I don't want to be reliant on one lender. I want to have access to the full industry. And I don't want to tell somebody who just came from Australia saying, you know what, we can't get your mortgage here. Yeah, but I want to put a big down payment. Doesn't matter. We can't get your mortgage here. Call me back in 3 years. No, I want to tell somebody, I have a solution. Here's a strategy. This is how we're going to do this. And you know what? We'll do this together. We're going to get there. Just be patient. Within 18 to 24 months, you'll be at your goal, basically. You know, and that's, I think, you know, it's a long-term play for us.
It's a little funny to think about this, but if DeFi was an option where there is no institution, it's just this digital body of where you can borrow money from, you would still be a consulting layer because there's obviously going to be a trust issue, especially early on, where people won't feel comfortable. Well, some people will, the early adopters will, but the majority of the population will be like, I'm not borrowing from this mythical digital, doesn't have a branch or a brand name or a you know, a company or a country or a government backing it up. It's just computers. And you come in and you kind of take them through the process, show them how it works. And that could be where, you know, you have a fee on top of things rather than a commission.
Exactly. Yeah. You give value, right? We're giving value. We are protecting the client from whatever he's going to do, because obviously if there's a thousand different financing sources or ways to get financing, well, how do you clarify that, right? Although it's a decentralized sort of environment, it's like, what's the best thing for me, for my situation, for my goals? Okay, we're going to go like this source, but we're going to do it like this. And, you know, and so I think that there, again, it's going to progress over the years. It won't be overnight. I think it takes time here, especially in Canada. But yes, there is going to be a very big wave of changes that are really coming to this environment. And that's why there was a report recently from BMO, actually, for the mortgage broker market for Canada, where, you know, they talked about the current market share and they believe it's going to mimic Australia. Actually, our banking system follows Australia after. And I think Australia has about 10% more market share in the mortgage broker space than here. So I think that they believe the mortgage broker space, where it's sort of, you know, advice driven, is going to grow versus the people walking into the branch. And I think it's going to grow even more over the years and everything.
Yeah. So you got to get your SEO up, get all that content out there, Teddy. I have a friend back in Australia. He was on the podcast as well. He's the founder of a company called Finder. And they're basically like an online education resource for comparing every type of loan, whether it's credit cards or banks or even cryptocurrency options. So, and they do so well because of the every single Google search for, you know, which credit card is better, which bank loan is better, shows up, his company, Finder. But anyway, we've been talking about the future here. I'd like to kind of maybe in the last few minutes, I know you've been here an hour. I really appreciate your time, Teddy. Bring it back to today. So let's discard the future and DeFi and everything and look at where we're at now, especially for, I guess I'm switching to the people you help here and all the questions they might have. I can ask a few. First of all, why do you think property, and I'm not just saying for Canada, but just as a general asset class, is the best or a good option, since obviously you put, you know, a lot of your, it sounds like most of your investment outside your own business has been in property. I don't know if you're in crypto. I don't know if you're in stocks or have other companies, but I'm assuming it's mostly property. Why do you still see property as a great choice for people?
Well, yes, I do have some stocks and stuff like that, but the majority is in real estate. Why? Because I think property has proven over the past X amount of years to be very safe. Especially here in Canada, it's been a safe investment. You can leverage it. It's easy to leverage versus, you know, stocks, a little more complicated to leverage. You can still leverage it, but not as much leverage as you can currently get here. And people can, you know, can sort of, you know, reach for higher levels by doing that. I believe that people like to touch something and have, say, that I own that and not like I own, you know, 65 shares of XYZ Bank, or whatever it is. And so I think that people like to actually have a tangible asset that they're able to touch. And I believe that there's a comfort level, like people feel safe with real estate. I know that, you know, in the States and whatever, there's a huge downturn in the late 2000s there. But again, it came back, it rebounded. And I feel it's a very, I think it's a safe investment. Again, can't be over leveraged. You can't, you know, bet the future on everything. But if you do it intelligently and you're able to, you know, to really understand the market, then you can make a lot of money here, especially with leverage. You can make a lot of money. And so that's really why I believe people are venturing to it. And more now, because so many people have to live somewhere as well, right? Like, you're not going to, whatever happens as a company, as a business, people need to go home somewhere and sleep somewhere. And that's essentially the base of real estate is, you know, people have to live somewhere. With the population always growing, there's going to be always more demand for real estate
there. I have a kind of angry girlfriend right now because she's like in that millennial group who have watched their parents' properties all go 10x in the last whatever number of years. And now they're priced. They feel like they're priced out of the market, especially with a standard salary job. And the expectation is, maybe this will happen, but I don't know if we're going to get another 10x run in property values to compare to what, you know, the boomer generation enjoyed. How do you suggest people who are right now looking at their first purchase, especially from the finance situation, because how much they can borrow, you know, what their stress test is for how much they can handle in repayments, what's the potential for future growth? Have we maxed, like, it's grown so much, how much more can it grow is always the classic question. How do you advise and talk to people like that? What do you suggest they do? You know, assuming they have like a 5% deposit, but it's a big chunk of their net worth.
First of all, I think you have to, whatever you buy, especially to live, has to be within your budget. So you make yourself a budget, you're saying, I can afford $2,000 a month, whatever it is. So then $2,000 a month equals X amount of mortgage. And then if you have 5%, it means X amount of value, property value. So you're like, okay, well, that's my comfort zone. That's where I can buy. And then you look for the areas that you can live in, right? And don't force yourself to live downtown Montreal because I want to be downtown Montreal. But my budget is another region of it. No, live within your means, right? So then once you have your price range, you have an option. You have a decision to make. Do I get a smaller place with a better location, or do I get a larger place on a location that's a little bit more limited, right? And that is, I can't decide that for anybody, you know. And everybody has their own wants and their own needs. I always tell people, just buy within your means. Do not buy too high, and then just be realistic about what you can buy. Because, you know, don't first searching for properties for $1 million if you're budget is $500,000, and although the bank is maybe going to approve you and we can find a way, so it doesn't make any sense to do that, you know? And so just really buy within your means, whatever is possible. And coming back to if you think it's going to be 10X, it's hard to predict the future, but it's what I'm, I think it's going to be stable. I think that, you know, maybe it will slow for sure. It can't continue like the way it is right now, but it will slow down. But will it go to negative 10x? I don't think so. I'm not betting on that with my holdings, but I think that it's going to go slow, especially here in Quebec. It's going to go up, you know, a slower pace. I think the rest of Canada will be very similar to that. There's still a lack of supply, and that's a huge, huge problem down here. And so the demand is maintaining. It's probably going to grow even more with immigration, with all the, you know, the COVID sort of hopefully ending soon and everything. So I am very bullish on the market, on the real estate market. I'm very bullish on where we're at. I think rates, although if they do go up, and hopefully don't go up too much there, but if they do go up, is manageable. We are qualifying people, like you said, the qualification rate. At much higher rates than what they're actually borrowing right now. So there is some play for an increase in rates. So I'm bullish on that. And I do think, as you said, it's an inflationary environment, and that's going to sort of help the values. And if it is an inflationary environment, you want to get in and own assets, because if you're holding cash when there's an inflationary environment, you're dead, basically, you know. So it's, you won't grow your net worth at all.
What's your thoughts about overseas property? You know, rather than buying where you are, buying where it's best on the planet for whatever your goals are.
I think there's great opportunities everywhere. I just don't, what I don't know, I don't invest in. Okay. And so I like to invest what I'm comfortable with. And if you are comfortable in the market in, you know, London, which is obviously a high price market, or Greece or Athens, or whatever, you know, then go ahead. But I wouldn't invest into areas that I'm not comfortable with personally. I'd like to do all my research and understand the market, and but yes, there will be opportunities. I'm sure everywhere there'll be opportunities, and I don't know enough about it to really make advice on that. And that's, you know, and even put my money there, you know. And
you've never done it?
No, I stick to what I know.
No property back in Greece in the birth?
No, not that I'm aware of. But no, it's just no. I really like to be conservative in that approach, and. Even within Montreal, there's certain areas that I will invest in. There's certain, like, although it might be a good opportunity, I'm not investing there because I don't know as much. I like to sort of almost have an arbitrage situation where, you know, I know it's undervalued, or I know that I'm buying at a certain price, which is expensive, but I know I can optimize the rents and optimize the building and create some value there. So if I'm doing that, I have to know the area, and that's really where I concentrate my efforts on.
There's people who seem to be able to buy a property every year, two a year, you know, it's their main strategy. And they're not necessarily flipping either. They're buying, maybe renovating, refinancing, and they just keep going and going and going. But a lot of people, when they go to the broker, they realize they can borrow against one property and then maybe they can refinance it and get their second one. But when they start hitting their third investment, they haven't been able to accrue any more capital for the down payments. It seems like they get stuck at that point, and, you know, commercial lending isn't really an option for them, you know, either. How do these people, these other people, do it? Are they always just being creative with where they're sourcing a down payment? Is it always a case where they just have a lot of cash flow, like they have a really high paying job, or they own a couple of businesses and that's returning cash, which they turn into the property market? Because you see the flip side of this, you see the clients and how they're able to accrue so many properties. So what's the most common, like, formula for consistent accumulation of properties?
I think it's buying well. Okay. First, number one is because you need a down payment. So you need to have the money for the down payment, whether it's through a refinance or whatever way, but you need money for the down payment. But if you buy well and you optimize it, then you're able to refinance and you buy something else. And that's what I've seen. Yes, prices have gone up and the market's gone crazy, so everybody's able to refinance and get money out. But it's really, you make money in the buy. You make money in the vision, right? If you're buying at the top of the market, let's say you're buying at, you know, a new construction condo that has, you know, whatever. Basically, you can't refinance in a year or two. You're stuck there for a certain amount of time. And then, you know, you accumulate some wealth because it will go up a little bit, but you won't be able to scale like that. The people have really done well and have been really scaled as they've used intelligent financing sources to their advantage by, you know, buying, renovating, or optimizing, and then refinancing and using the money for something like that and doing that whole process again, but being also like very, very you know, you're very careful what you where you position your money in, and not just buying to buy. People who buy to buy will eventually get burnt, and it's going to burn out. And it's, again, when you're using leverage, if you make a mistake, it's going to cost you money as well. So you have to be careful. And so on my end, it's really the players who are doing this know the situation and understand the value. I have a friend in Ottawa. He buys a house. He says, well, there's X amount of square feet. I'm going to put a 20-unit building on that. And he knows the value, how much he's going to do, what the bank – he knows exactly every step of the way. Amazing job he's doing. But he has so much knowledge, so much unfair. So really, if you want to get into that, or whoever wants to get into that, just learn. Learn about the different areas, concentrate on a certain amount of areas, and try to look for the arbitrage opportunities. There's always an opportunity to just understand where it's at. And just be careful where you put your money in.
Sounds like leverage specialization, just getting, you know, familiar, practice doing a certain strategy and learning from it. So last question, I think, we'll see. The future for Group Orbis and Teddy, you own a lot of property. You said you want to double the size of, you know, how many people you've got working with Group Orbis. I've always been curious, like a person like yourself, when your property is like this strategy, do you plan on just like that's your legacy? You pass that on to the family, or is there a point where one day you sell it and then buy a big yacht? And then with the business, same story. Like at some point, I assume you would retire. Would you sell the business, or does it maintain ownership in the family? And it's, you know, you hope maybe some of your children take over, or you just take cash flow and that's what your family onwards. Like, what's the plan for the future?
It's hard to say what the future is going to be. I'm just focused on really the next, you know, a year or two. Now, you know, would I be on a big yacht and sell it? I like to work. I like to vacation, don't get me wrong, you know, and I like to go to Florida every so often. But, you know, I think that I would get bored of that after some amount of time, and whether I sell it or whatever is going to happen, I'm open. Again, you have to always be open to all the different opportunities and open what's happening in the future. But I'm not going to just, this is not going to be like, I build it up to sell. This is not what I want. It's really, I'm building something that I truly think there's value, and I think that there's a future here. On the flip side, I don't necessarily want to just hand this over to my children or hand over, you know, I think that they have to work for what they, you know, what they get in life. And, I think, yeah, you want to help them out and support them with, you know, educationally, support them maybe with starting in their start, but you want them to build their own legacy as well. And maybe, you know, at a certain time, maybe able to donate some money to different causes and to grow within that type of scope as well. So I do have some plans, but on my end, it's really just, I'm focused on the growth, the immediate growth of Orbis. And I think that's a huge potential here in Canada and Quebec, especially the market's shifting and we'll see how far we can go. I think that I've seen other stories that have been really, really good, and, you know, I'll try to model after some of them, and just seeing how to grow that and having the right people around you is the key for me there.
Okay, great. I do have one more question, Teddy. It's for the audience, really. If a person has been listening to this and they're like, I am really interested in becoming a mortgage broker. They're not necessarily in Montreal, of course. They could be anywhere on the planet. What type of person is well suited to become a mortgage broker? And bearing in mind, they're obviously starting from scratch. So, you know, what's the strategy today to get into the mortgage brokering world?
So what I look for in somebody, it's really a go-getter, somebody who's not shy. Although, you know, maybe when I first started, I was shy, but it's learning to sort of get out of your comfort zone. And somebody's hungry, somebody wants to achieve, and it's good with the numbers, analytical. So if you don't want to work, if you're lazy, which some people, a lot of people are, which is fine. You know, it's not really the job for you. It's there's a lot of, and you can't get too stressed out because it's a very high ticket size. So you can be going from making $10,000 one hour, then next the bank refuses it, and you made zero. So like people who can't control their emotions, who are very stressed, this is not the job for you. But if somebody's even keel, and again, it's you learn as you go, but somebody's even keel is very hungry, is focused, they will achieve. They will have success. And you have to enjoy the numbers. You just don't do this for the money. You have to actually enjoy the business, enjoy investing into something that is really interesting. And you know, that's the key. If somebody just says, "Oh, hey, I want to make $100,000," it won't work because you're just going to think about the money. And whatever deal I do, I don't think about the money. I think about what I have to do, and in the end, you'll make money. But it's really the person, and that's all I look for in people: people who are motivated. If you're not motivated, if you're not hungry, it's not going to work out. It doesn't matter how many people you know in the industry there, you know.
You have to be a people person, I would assume, right? Because you're going to spend a lot of time interacting with people.
100%, yes. You can't be shy. You have to be a people person. You have to be able to go in public and, you know, not necessarily beg for business, but ask for business. And just being, you have to be smart, because the ones who have made good money, they have been focused. They've treated it as a business, and they're not just, you know, randomly working one day, the next day they take the day off. They're consistent in what they do. And it's really, going out and just trying to do the same thing every day that made you had success, and keep on pushing it, basically, you know, and keep on doing the right actions, and staying, have the right mindset, stay motivated.
Nice. All right, Teddy, thank you so much. If someone wants to get in touch with you, and any other websites you want to send people to, what are the contact points?
So if you want to, you can email me at, the best way is info@grouporbis.com. It goes straight to me. If you have any group with an E, it's the French way. And you're free to email me. And, if you have any questions, I'm open to anything. It's a pleasure, Yarrow. Thank you very much for having me. I think it was a great experience. And I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Teddy. And I'll put the Group Orbis website with the links to the show notes and everything as well. But thank you for the time.
Thank you, Yarrow. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Teddy. It was fantastic to share a story from the world of financing and property investing on Vested Capital. I have obviously a lot of startup founders, and Teddy, of course, started his own mortgage brokerage. So there is a startup story to learn from here. But I also really appreciated his insight into the financing of property purchases and of course, his own strategy as a property investor over the years. It's a fun industry. It's an exciting industry. I think a certain personality type would really benefit and could seriously make amazing cash flow if you're the kind of person who loves to talk to people, meet people. What I especially feel is an opportunity for those who commit to becoming a mortgage broker or working in basically any type of finance or property investing, that kind of world. It seems to really reward people who do a good job of building up a base of relationships with ancillary services and companies and people that work in them. For example, Teddy working with a lot of real estate agents and vice versa, real estate agents working with a lot of mortgage brokerage and bankers, you get that kind of referral process going. And once those relationships are really cemented, they become like consistent sources of new leads. I think back to my own experience here in Montreal. I landed as, a new person coming to stay in Montreal and buy a property. And I initially did some Google search to find a real estate agent to help me with just getting a basic understanding. And my Google search led me to some real estate agents that I contacted, and I had some good conversations. I actually met a couple. One of them drove me around some areas, but none of them really, grabbed my attention and were trying to go above and beyond. At the same time as I was looking for a real estate agent, I was also looking for a mortgage broker. And the same thing, I went to Google, I searched for a Montreal mortgage broker, and I came across this gentleman named George. He had one of the highest ranking websites. SEO is so important for these type of services, especially local based SEO. I get in touch with George. We have a great phone call. At the end of the phone call, he's basically telling me, well, I don't think I can help you because I don't specialize in the type of financing you need, but I do have some contacts. And also, do you need a real estate agent? And I said, I have someone I kind of started working with. And he basically convinced me to meet with a friend of his named Anna, a real estate agent here in Montreal, who I then met with, who was just so much more motivated and, excited to work with me. It's a bit of a funny story, but she also at the time, and we're talking around 2018, I think it was, or 19, she was invested in Bitcoin. And I was like, well, I haven't met many real estate agents that, are invested in Bitcoin or know what Bitcoin is. So I also took that as a positive sign, a forward-thinking, kind of up-to-date real estate agent. So I started working with Anna, and Anna then connected me with Teddy, who was on, the guest today for the podcast. And that was all through these connections and relationships. They all refer to each other because they built these relationships and they've, pass clients back and forth, whether they need financing or real estate agent services and so on. And for a person who's getting into these industries, assuming you do the hard work of those first 1, 2, 3 years, I think Teddy's story at the start was a good example. You build up these contacts, and then this amazing thing happens where the word of mouth starts to take over, and that expands your initial base of clients, which then it's like a flywheel, a compounding effect. Those clients bring in more clients. Those relationships with real estate agents and brokers bring in more clients. And you don't have to kind of like hustle as hard to make those first contacts, because all the work you did in the past is starting to really just fill your calendar with meetings and opportunities and obviously doing the service for your clients. And that to me felt similar to any kind of small business analogy. Often when you get that kind of product market fit or service market fit and people start to really benefit from what you do, they do start talking. You start building a few key referral relationships with the kind of people who can send you the right potential clients, and vice versa. You can potentially send them the right people. Maybe not, but you just have that relationship in place. And then it just starts to build up. And then suddenly, your leads are all coming from previous clients and previous relationships instead of these new people you've had to meet, or paid advertising, or, all those traditional forms of marketing and advertising that are, obviously they take resources in terms of money to make work, where the relationships and the word of mouth can just be running out there without you being involved anymore. So I loved hearing that part of Teddy's story, and also that is a key strategy that he's passed on to all the brokers that work in his company, Group Orbis, too. So great interview. Hopefully you took something from it, regardless of your own strategies with cash flow from properties or financing investments, or just even the future of this kind of space, as we talked about a few different topics. And who knows, maybe you might decide to get into mortgage brokering yourself. As you can tell, it is sort of like, it's like having your own business, and you do have the potential to earn pretty significant cash flow. And then naturally you will understand the opportunity to invest in property and very likely turn that mortgage brokering cash flow back into your own property investments. Okay, so if everything that you've heard today appeals to maybe someone you know in your family or your colleague or partner, anyone you think might benefit from hearing from Teddy and this story, please share this episode with Vested Capital. It's episode number 27 with Teddy Karas, and just send it to them either directly with a link to the post on my blog, that's yaro.blog, or you can share the link on Spotify or on Apple iTunes or on Google Podcasts. And all the most common popular apps are available. You'll find Vested Capital. You can just search for Vested Capital, search for Yaro, you'll find the show. Make sure when you're there, you subscribe, you follow, you hit the plus button, whatever it is, so that you get all my episodes as I release them. And I've got a lot in the queue. I've been really doing many interviews recently with quite a variety of different types of specialists in making money and growing capital and just new modern forms of business, DeFi, crypto, obviously with property today and financing, and of course, startups like SaaS, M&A, really interesting topics. I'm really enjoying doing these interviews. And of course, there's more coming up as well. So make sure you don't miss them. Subscribe to Vested Capital. And if you have time and you've really appreciated this, I would really appreciate it if you would leave a review. 5-star review. Just give me a sentence saying how much you like the show. That really helps with the rankings of all these episodes in Apple iTunes, which still, presently at least, is the dominant player in podcasts. Spotify is catching up. But the more reviews you make, the better I'll have access to new audience, which then, of course, in turn means I can make more episodes. I have access to more resources and, I'm more appealing to sponsors, which means I can then build a team and bring in more amazing guests, higher quality guests, more famous guests, more frequent podcasts. It's better for you. So I'd really appreciate it if you could do that. Just take 5 minutes now, open up the Apple iTunes link for Vested Capital and click the review button in your iTunes app, the podcast app. And that would be amazing. And I'd be eternally grateful. Okay, my name is Yaro, and I will speak to you on the very next episode of Vested Capital. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.